The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I promised questions for this week. So questions. Questions can be pretty much about any topic Dharma related. It might be about your practice, whether that's about meditation practice, formal meditation practice, or practice in your daily life. It could be a question about a Dharma topic. It could be a specific question about how to apply a Dharma topic, or it might be a more general question like, you know, talk about impermanence. So I'm open to, you know, any kinds of questions. If you have a question, you can think of it almost as an offering to the room. I know sometimes it's hard to ask the first question. It seems the first questions take some time to get out there, and then after that it seems to flow a little bit more easily. Yeah, thanks.
I heard a talk the other day on home, what it means to be or feel at home. Are there any teachings in the Buddhist tradition that relate to being home or finding home?
I guess I would say, you know, what I think of when you say home, or when I think of being home, it's being home here. It's being home in this body, in this being. And that, I mean, in different language, to me, that is what the practice of mindfulness is about. It's about opening to the entirety of our human experience, actually learning to be at home in our being. There's so many things I think that keep us from being at home, keep us from feeling like we are really okay in our own being. To me, that's what being at home would feel like, is when it feels okay, when it feels, you know, home has a connotation of safety and comfort and anything else you can think of there.
At peace,
yeah. It's got a connotation of those things. And so what might it mean to be at home anywhere, to be at home in this mind and body at any time? This is really what the Buddha pointed to, a kind of a safety, a peace that's not dependent on conditions. You know, safety in this sense isn't what we might normally think of as safety. You know, safe, objective safety, where nobody is going to harm me. That's often what we think of as safety. Instead, what the safety of our practice points to is a safety from states of mind that keep us from being at peace. So it's the Buddha pointed to three core root states of mind that keep us from being at peace, and these keep us from feeling at home in our lives. The wanting, the leaning toward something, greed, desire for things to be a certain way, aversion, a not wanting, kind of the flip side of wanting. We can want something to be not this. You know, we can want to have something. That's more the sense of what wanting is. Aversion is more not this. I have a really clear understanding of this. It's like it doesn't matter what else it is. It's just like just not this. Anything else would be better than this. That's that experience of aversion. So wanting and aversion. And the political climate, yes, indeed. And then a delusion, a confusion about, delusion's a really broad, it's got a lot to it. I may talk about that a little bit more thoroughly this morning, if that's of interest. But just briefly, there's different kinds of delusion. Delusion basically is keeping us from being with what's here, actually with what's here. It's a kind of a veil that separates us from what's actually here. And maybe we could say that veil separates us from being at home, from feeling at home in our experience. That veil might be experienced as not being present for what's here, so not home at all. Just checked out. So that it might be that kind of veil, or it can be a veil that actually is more transparent, that we can see what's here, or we think we see what's here, but we're seeing from a perspective, actually we're seeing more what we think is here rather than what's actually there. It's, we're seeing things through a filter, view, opinion, belief. This is a huge form of delusion that is not so apparent to us because we often, basically, don't see our beliefs. We take them to be truths, and those beliefs, those kind of the subterranean beliefs, the ones that we just live in thinking that's the way life is, they really influence how we take in information, what we actually receive from the world. And so that's a form of being separate from what is actually here. And so the Buddha's teachings about being in the present moment asks us to really thoroughly investigate our wanting and our aversion, first of all, to thoroughly investigate that, because the wanting something to be other than it is, the not wanting something to be as it is, they keep us in a state of kind of being off kilter, of being out of balance, essentially feeling like home isn't okay at this moment. Home is not okay. Something has to change. Something else needs to happen. And so this is the Buddha asks us to investigate that, to look at that. Not to just say, greed and aversion are the problem. I need to get rid of them. That itself would be aversion, aversion to those states. And so the Buddha asks us, actually, investigation is a key piece of learning. What does it mean to be at home? What does that mean? What does it mean to land here in the present moment? And so we look at our wanting something, to have something that's not here. We look at the wanting to get rid of something that is here. And, the wanting itself, the aversion itself, when we begin to see that, when we begin to explore that experience itself, we see that it's that feeling of wanting is actually what is kind of keeping us off kilter. The feeling of wanting or aversion itself is unpleasant, is not satisfying. In fact, the wanting itself creates the feeling of dissatisfaction. The aversion itself creates the feeling of dissatisfaction. And so looking at that, we begin to recognize that wanting and aversion themselves, in this very moment, and I think home means in this very moment, feeling at home. And so the wanting and the aversion are kind of a something that keeps us off of feeling at home now, in the belief that, because these qualities of aversion and greed have beliefs associated with them, delusions associated with them, that wanting, the belief associated with wanting, is something along the lines of, if I get that thing, then I'll feel at home. If I get rid of that thing, then I'll feel at home. Essentially, putting the feeling at home into the future somewhere, into the not here, into this not this moment. And so that belief around wanting and aversion is essentially willing to give up home now for some possible home in the future. So as we explore that, we begin to see and feel into. So as we open to, you know, the practice that the Buddha pointed to, is it's hard medicine. You know, it's like, yeah, pay attention to that wanting. What does that wanting feel like? Yeah, it doesn't feel very good. Okay, what does that aversion feel like? Oh, that doesn't feel very good either. But that learning right there begins to point to, it's like our system. Our system begins to understand in this moment, oh, wanting actually isn't well-being in this moment. It's not feeling at home in this moment. Aversion is not feeling at home in this moment. And so the system begins to understand that, to get that education, and begins to... It's like our system begins to understand how to let that go. Now, I say this a lot, but I have to keep repeating it because it keeps being misunderstood. So when I say that, you know, wanting is the cause of the dissatisfaction, and that the wanting can be released as we discover the aversion, they're very similar energies in a way. They're kind of flip sides of each other, different sides of the same coin. You know, the wanting and the aversion is the dissatisfaction, is the not being at home, and that as those release, we feel at home in this moment, whatever the conditions are in the world. Our mind, from the perspective of wanting or aversion, hears that and thinks, oh, being at home means that I don't want to do anything. Being at home means that I don't care about anything. Or being at home because I don't want to change anything. We hear that, you know, non-greed and non-aversion as non-action. You know, it's like, why would I do something if I didn't want it? Why would I do something if I didn't want to get rid of something? Why? Why would I do anything? From the perspective of wanting, again, a belief associated with wanting, one of the delusions associated with wanting, is I'm the only way things happen in this world. Desire is the only fuel for getting things done. Wanting is the only fuel for accomplishing anything, for doing anything. If I didn't exist, nothing would happen. So that is the belief of that wanting, you know, in their aversion too. And so from that perspective, I hear this from people sometimes. It's like, I don't know if I want that. You know, I don't know if I want to let go of wanting. You know, I don't want to just not care about things. And it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to explore and recognize that actually as wanting lets go, as aversion lets go, the heart, what happens, as the heart starts to more thoroughly receive this moment, thoroughly be home in this moment, this heart starts like resonating in tune with the world. It resonates to the joys of the world, and it resonates to the suffering of the world. And in that resonation, in that resonance, the heart leaps in joy with the joy and wants to act from compassion to alleviate suffering. And so the qualities of, you know, some beautiful qualities in the heart, kindness, love, compassion, joy, wisdom or understanding, these qualities also have a doing and a motivating quality to them. It's got a kind of intention to act in the world, wanting, and we can tell the difference between them. At least in my experience, the difference between the wanting to have something, the kind of, and the wanting to get rid of something, is there's a constricted feeling to that kind of a wanting. It's the not at home feeling, that crunch, that tightness. And when the wanting and the aversion and the delusion let go, the heart is not constricted and wants to respond to the world rather than control the world. So it's a kind of a difference between wanting to control and wanting to, like, move and do what's possible in the world. So that's enough for now. I see a couple more questions kind of coming, so...
My life.
We all have. We've been wanting and averting all our lives. Yes.
Almost every thought, every motive.
Yeah. Go ahead and use. Is it on?
Every thought, every motive is all around either wanting or averting. That's what I've been doing. And so a couple years ago,
I mean, you talk about
to this planner, this wanter, this adverter, all of her life to say, you know, go where the love is. Go where you're the most comfortable. Go where you're at home.
Uh-huh.
And it has nothing to do with where I physically live.
Yes.
So it's been quite the journey.
So you point to, following the heart. Following the heart. There is some wisdom. There's wisdom in there that helps us to find our way without that constriction. And yet the teaching ultimately is that we can also be at home in places where we feel less at home at this point, you know, that can happen, that we can. And yet I would say that in our training, in our in our, especially in our spiritual practice. It can be really helpful to kind of, it's like, start where it's easiest. You know, start where the heart, you know, it's like our heart can't open to everything at once. It can't. And so it's like, find the conditions in which the heart can open a little bit. And then we can stretch the boundaries of that, and stretch the boundaries of that, and stretch the boundaries of that. So that sounds like what you're doing, essentially.
As long as my
here.
Mind doesn't get in the way, because it's pretty scary when my mind starts getting in the way. I guess the one thing that just kind of, I'll never understand it, is this happened about a year ago, and I don't know if it's related to my spiritual journey, but I can't understand it. So I had a retreat. I have a son, and he was studying abroad in Florence, and he was back in the States, and we were to meet a couple weeks later. And that was fine. I hadn't seen him in a year. So I had a retreat in Santa Cruz. I attend the Insight Center. They just moved also to a new center in Santa Cruz, and I attend that center. So I got up on a Saturday morning. I had booked this retreat a couple weeks prior, and it was a two-day retreat. And I got in my car from Redwood, and I go to the center. And across the street was a market, and I went there to get some coffee. And I turned down an aisle, and there stood my son and his girlfriend. So I was like, this is my Dharma son. You know, how did that happen? Uh-huh. You know, just how did that happen? So anyway, if I continue to just follow my heart and not get too preoccupied with the wanting, averter, planner, and just keep doing, you know, what makes me...
So there's a couple pieces in there. You know, it's like not get preoccupied. Yes, it's really helpful, especially initially as we explore. You know, we see. It's like we start to look at our minds. It doesn't take us long to see exactly what you saw. Wow, I've been doing this all my life. This is how I have lived my life. It's like this shows you the power of the delusion of wanting and aversion. Hey, this is how things get done in the world. It's not just you. It's a very human condition that this is the case. And so not to explore what it means to not, what were the words you use? Not give in to or use some word I can't remember. Succumb to, you know, not so to recognize it's happening, you know, to see the process. Oh yeah, I really want that. To be curious about that experience itself and see if you can not follow through on it. And we can do that by just kind of saying, okay, yeah, I see that, and I'm just not going to go there right now. You know, I'm just not going to do that one right now. You know, we have this. You know, pull to do something or to get rid of something. And it's like, well, let me just see. You know, what if I just don't do that? Sometimes that we can just not do that thing, kind of just set it aside and go on with our day. And we just kind of forget about that thing that we wanted or wanted to get rid of. It's just kind of like wanting kind of disappears in the background. And that's fine, and that's a way that it begins. It was kind of like a setting aside of the wanting. It's like, yeah, I just don't need to go there. Let me put my attention on this other thing that I know is more helpful. So it's kind of a redirecting of the attention. Really helpful to explore that. And then another deepening of the practice can happen, and this is easier, I think, in the formal practice than necessarily in daily life, although I've seen it happen in daily life too. I'm able to do this at times in daily life where I'm curious about the wanting or the aversion itself. It's like, wow, I really want to do that thing. If I've got the time, you know, if I'm not in the midst of a conversation or in the midst of some activity that needs my attention, I may take the time. It's like, well, let me see. What does that wanting feel like? You know, can I just watch the wanting? Watch that experience of wanting. And this exploration where we choose to turn towards the wanting or turn towards the aversion, kind of land in that experience of what does it mean, and this can be a good question, what does it mean to be a human being that wants something? What does it mean to be a human being that doesn't want something? So it takes it out of the personal and more into the the human realm. It's like just exploring that. What does that mean? I'll offer a teaching from James Baraz that I think is a really helpful way to frame the question, kind of a fun, playful way to frame the question. He talks about at a certain point in his practice, he pretended like he was an alien who came and took up residence in a human being. And his job as an alien was to report back to the mothership. What is it like when human beings feel this? What is it like when human beings feel wanting? What is it like when human beings feel aversion? So that was the way he explored it. And it again, it takes it out of the realm of the personal. Oh, what do I want? I want that thing. It's like, no, well, this is a human experience. Can I explore the human experience of wanting? And so exploring that human experience of wanting, first of all, you find out that wanting itself doesn't feel very good. You know, that and aversion itself doesn't feel very good. And that, again, that's part of the education that mindfulness offers us, because it illuminates, it reveals the misconception around wanting that I'll be at home in the future. I'm willing to let go of being home now. Yeah, that being home in the future, that's maybe I can do that. I'm willing to let go of being home now. And so that exploration of the wanting itself in the moment gives us that education, gives our system the education around the unpleasantness, the unwell-beingness of wanting and aversion right here and now. And our system begins to be curious about it. And this is, again, it's a leap of faith. It's an act of trust to be curious about those states, not to try to get rid of them, but to kind of allow them to loosen, allow them to weaken. And sometimes as we watch wanting weaken, as we get curious about it and just watch it weaken, there's a couple things that can happen. One, we might see wanting release. We might see it let go. That's an amazing experience. If you actually see the moment that wanting releases, I mean, even a simple wanting, like on one retreat, I wanted to look at people. It was a long retreat, and it was even my first long retreat. And I really wanted to look at people, but we had been instructed not to look at people. So I was being a dutiful yogi and not looking at people. And boy, did I want to look at people, but I was just following the instructions. I kind of like had blinders on. I was just forcing myself not to look at people. But this wanting kept going and kept going and kept going. And I was just forcing myself not to look. And at some point, you know, couple weeks into this retreat, it finally occurred to me, oh, right, they tell us to watch this. What wanting is happening. Maybe I should watch this. I'm a little slow sometimes. So I decided to start being curious about the wanting and just watching the wanting. And I watched it. I watched it spring into being as somebody came into my field of vision. I watched it vanish as somebody went out of my field of vision. And in the watching it vanish, it felt like I was released from a vice grip. It was a huge release, a huge feeling of well-being, of being at home in the moment. And so we learn also from that. You know, we learn, wow, I didn't actually need that thing I thought I wanted to be happy. The release from the wanting is a much deeper kind of happiness than I ever could have imagined. And so we might explore that. We might explore that the wanting itself goes away and the release and ease that comes with that. And we might also find there's ways in which we see as wanting releases. It's like sometimes the releasing of wanting takes us back not to, having to have that thing, but the opening of the heart of loving that experience. And so sometimes as we explore the release of the wanting, it puts us into that more open-hearted space where we see the compassion or the love that motivates. And so again, you know, the release of the wanting, we may find, sometimes we find, and many, many times, wanting is about something that is not necessary. It's not really that useful to us. It's just wanting. Many times that's the case. You know, I think that we get caught on the internet through this kind of wanting, you know, this endless wanting information or wanting to find something to entertain us, you know. It's like, so that kind of wanting is, you know, what we see as we explore the wanting, is it that kind of wanting that doesn't really need to be satisfied? Or is it the kind of wanting that's connected to a deeper heartfelt wish to alleviate suffering or to act in response to the world? And so the mindfulness begins to open us to, it doesn't just take us to non-action. It does take us to non-action if it's something that's not necessary. But it leaves space for something else to happen. And it opens us to, you know, the truth of, yeah, things are unreliable and out of control, but, you know, the heart wants to respond here. The heart, out of compassion, acts or connects or resonates with love and kindness. So, did you have another?
Your response, which I've appreciated a lot, suggests to me that my wanting and aversion, as when they're present, and they are often present, is a kind of homelessness, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
And this talk I heard the other day suggested that one of the reasons, perhaps, that I react or others react aversively toward the unhoused in our society is because it reminds us that we're homeless in some sense or other.
Mm, that's an interesting
and it seemed to fit.
Yeah. Interesting way to think about it. Yeah.
Thank you. There was something that I had been avoiding taking care of at home because of the strong aversion to looking at this. It was like old paperwork that really had just been kind of cluttering up closets, and I really need to downsize things in my apartment so that I can think about moving to a smaller place. And I had been living with the aversion of not going in there for so long because I was afraid of what it was going to stir up in me, because it's all this old financial paperwork having to do with when I was married a long time ago. And as I'm going through there and I'm shredding old check registers and returns and things that I really don't need anymore, and I was just appalled at the amount of senseless spending that we had done at that time when we thought we could. And it made me feel a little bit like less unhappy about my current state of financial affairs, that I, how much it was weighing down on me. And so
how much what was weighing down on you?
How much avoiding dealing
avoiding,
with
yes.
it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yes.
I had avoided going into this closet because I was afraid, okay, it's going to be all the memories of this person and all of the things. And then when I'm looking at it, it's kind of a relief to say, oh my God, thank goodness I don't have $1,500 payments to American Express every month or something. And like, what the heck did we buy? I mean, you know, really. And so, you know, so much of my life has been just stepping back from avoiding, and going into this, I was like,
some trepidation.
Yeah, there was some trepidation, but then there was that delusion of what was it going to take to make us happy. So yeah. You know, the
so recognizing that you're not in that delusion now, there was a kind of a delight.
Yeah,
and so that's a beautiful thing to recognize. It's like, it's in some ways it's a pointer to things that have been released. You know, kind of a way of life, views of how to live life that are no longer operating in you, and you feel in this moment now the release of burden of that, or the non-burdensomeness of that.
It's right.
Not, you're feeling not so much the release of it, but that it is not burdening you. Mm-hmm. And almost in that reflection, you see, wow, that experience was much more weighed down than I knew even at the time. That's how delusion works.
Right.
We have no idea. So that's a great example of delusion, and how on this path often we see the delusions that have been let go much after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we come upon something or we recognize something, it's like, wow, that's not there now. Wow, I'm so happy that that's not there now. So that's another, and, you know, just bringing back to delusion, you know, beautiful part of this practice. So appreciating that, you know, we can,
and like you've said
that.
About being with that sensation instead of being in it, or experience, you know, like I had had this fear of going into the closet because I was afraid that I would still have those strong feelings of whatever
yes.
emotions they would stir up, but it was the being with going through it,
that
and it wasn't wasn't so scary, and I was able to deal with it, and I was able to have some neutrality towards what I was seeing there, and just kind of like the light bulb going on about I was avoiding going in there because I was afraid it would rekindle all the feelings.
Right.
But I was able to see it from a different perspective.
So that being with, you know, it sounds like you went into it like, okay, you know, this is a great way to use practice. You know, it's like, wow, there's something I've been avoiding. I'm afraid of it. There's some trepidation. It's like, okay, you know, this is a project. Let's have it be a mindfulness project. Okay, I'm going to take half an hour. That's going to be my meditation right now of starting to go through this and see what can I be with. And as you point out, the being with, and I love that language. It's so much, it's evocative of what we're trying to do with the mindfulness, to be with what's happening. And as you explored the being with, you saw that the difficult states were not so difficult. You were able to meet them, and it left the space for you to see this understanding of, oh, look at this. I'm happy that I'm not burdened by that anymore. So it creates conditions both for, you know, the more ease with being with difficulty and the revealing of the beauty.
Sometimes in awareness, you know, everything kind of falls away, and then there's this flow from a deeper place, and it feels authentic, and then, but life circumstances don't necessarily allow that flow to go where it's wanting to go.
Yeah.
So then this conflict, it's like how to both listen to that deeper self, but then I guess not get attached at the same time. And both my husband and I are going through this, and then we've ended up in the old power play of, well, my authentic self and yours. our two authentic selves aren't going the same direction, right? So there's that piece, and then there's also kind of this piece, it's similar, but Well, so not wanting nothing. So there's no self here to want anything and just cruising along. And then, well, maybe I should want something so life can happen here. And then finding that and then getting attached to it.
Yeah.
So those are kind of my questions.
Well, you know, the wanting has no shame. It can get attached to anything. It can get attached to beautiful states of concentration. It can get attached to a sense of well-being. It can get attached to... It's like, as we practice, we open to, you know, really the well-being of not needing to control or to have things in a certain way. And it feels good. In a little moment of habit, which is long practiced, wanting wants more of that. It wants more of that. It's like, oh, you know, touching into that sense of flow. Oh, want more of that. You know, I want more of that. So, you know, the practice keeps coming back to, oh, wanting to be in touch with that. So, you know, as the practice deepens, we can you know, keep deepening that. It's the same work. It's the same work over and over again. It's just subtler things that we want, almost. You know, it's like the mind just searches for something to satisfy itself with. So, you know, watching the searching. You know, it's not even necessarily that it knows what it wants, but it figures there's got to be something out there to want, so let me find it. So what is that searching feeling? So that searching feeling, I find, happens more as we, you know, get a little further in our spiritual practice, because the searching comes right into the practice. You know, so it's like almost it gets obscured, because it's like, oh, I'm supposed to want to practice, and so it kind of gets hooked. That wanting gets hooked to the practice and searching for the right practice or searching for something. And so again, it's like when we see that, it's like, oh right, okay, searching is happening. Can I know that? Wanting a particular state, wanting to be resonant with that state of well-being. That's happening. It's not that we have to throw out the well-being or you know, the sense that, yes, that's the direction. But there's a way in which the wanting has kind of clamped down on it. It's the clamping down that needs to be released, not the state. And so this is really where observing the wanting bears a lot of fruit. To really, you know, it's like as the wanting releases, we find ourselves more and more in that authentic state. And then the authentic state, or let's just call it a state of allowing what's here to be flowing through. And, you know, so you, the first place you started around, you know, what does my authentic self want? That's what I'd look at, the wanting right there, because that space of really being in tune with this, you know, being at home, really being at home. The wanting is not necessary. So if there's something that it feels like the authentic self wants, that's interesting. So what is that? First of all, you know, sometimes it's like it doesn't even know what it wants. It just feels like it wants. So like, okay, like wanting. So just watch the wanting. Curiosity about the wanting. You know, there are needs that our being has, you know, like needing to be fed, needing to have clothes, needing to, you know. So there are needs like that need to be taken care of. And yet, you know, so what is at the level of those kinds of basic needs and what is at a different kind of level. And so, you know, there are, I think, different ways that beings' trajectories, like, pull them. Like, you know, for me, attending long retreat has been a trajectory that has felt like there's a kind of a pull in that direction. And so when it's possible, I do that. And then, you know, in a partnership, there might be different, you know, different kind of pulls and different directions of that being. That may be what you're talking to about, what your authentic self wants. And yet you're in a relationship, and so there's some way in which the exploration needs to be around, you know, okay, given the conditions of this, what do we do? How do we respond? It's like maybe seeing it as a system rather than two individuals. And, you know, exploring, there's a way to explore a system. You know, it's not so much taught in this practice. You know, we very much do a, you know, mindfulness, inward mindfulness in this practice. But you could even explore it with the form, with the tools that we have, the mindfulness, in relationship. You know, the one way that can start with. And I learned this from another teacher in a different tradition, Hamid Ali. He, you know, really does a relational practice. And, you know, a way you could begin exploring it is to sit down with your partner and begin, you know, describing what is it like to be here now sitting with you. And in doing that kind of a relational practice, there's a third entity that is, it's the experience, there's an experience of a third entity there that you can both be mindful of. And what is that entity? What is the direction of that entity? And sometimes, you know, for some entities, it has a direction that it wants to go, and sometimes that entity may say, okay, well, then we need to do different things in this space. But you might explore that shared experience with mindfulness. See what happens.
Yeah, in terms of relationship, that would reorient the, get it back off the me-you thing and back into the we thing.
Yes.
And for us, fortunately, the practice is the core of our relationship. So that's why it's been particularly distressing to have this, it get in the way. The two things that came up while you were talking, one is just a tremendous sadness or pain about that very process of how we could take something so precious and wonderful and constrain
it
again,
human.
But
it's
what we do.
It is completely what we do. It's like, it's not personal, believe me, it is not personal.
But
recognizing it, right? It's like, okay, this is wanting and aversion and delusion at work. This needs to be explored.
And the other related to that is like what I got all this time sitting here, being with that wanting and what's been happening is it's like the grasping little girl, the 3-year-old, just asserting herself again, just doesn't want to die or doesn't want to be on pause.
Yeah.
I know she doesn't have to die, but wants to assert herself, you know, and come back
can
to life.
Can you be with that?
Right. Well,
this is what it feels like to be the 3-year-old that wants. Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's a cycle of temper tantrums and excitement. And, you know,
yes.
What one would expect.
Yes, exactly. And it can be met in a container that holds it in a different way. Very different than, you know, how it possibly was met when you were growing up. You know, it's like okay, you know, it's like, temper tantrum away. We can hold it. we can meet with this. Oh, okay. Oh. And there can be this kind of poignancy and a tenderness towards that, you know, towards that three-year-old. Yeah. And could you pass the mic back to John?
I could never. I know you mentioned moment many times.
And it's on, yeah.
Yeah, and many Buddhists do that. But I personally, I can never find that moment. I always look for that moment, and it's never there. I'm never in the moment. But let me explain. Let me explain.
Okay.
Because I know you think, wow, that's really weird. You're meditating and you can't be in the moment.
No, I know. I have a sense of what you might mean. But explain.
What I mean is that I find myself in the space. You have two moments. In that moment, there is space. And if you look at inside that space, it becomes infinite.
Uh-huh.
But the space itself is interesting, more interesting than the moment for me. Maybe you can comment on that.
So, by space you mean kind of what's holding experience?
No, you can't put anything on it. It's a sense feeling, but it's a sense of space.
You feel that you're in that space. It's like when you play an instrument and there's a
the flow, kind of a flow.
There's one beat and then another beat. But if you look inside that, those two beats, there is something there that's really very pleasant.
Uh-huh. Okay. When you say you look in the moment and it's infinite, now that to me, I mean, it's like...
It seems like it's really bigger than what it really is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is. It's like it's everything. You know, this. There's nothing else. Nothing else. And it's not that there's a place to this moment. It's already vanishing. It's there's no place to land in here and now. It's like quicksand. It's just slipping, and that to me, I don't know if this is the same as what you mean by space, but entering into that, the recognition of there actually isn't a place to land in now. It's there's a kind of a sense of the willingness to be in the slipping away of things and the arising of things. Things arise and slip away simultaneously. And it can be very beautiful. It can also be very unsettling at times. So I would call it, there is a state in which that it's possible to see that. And maybe that's what you mean by space.
Yes.
That it's a kind of a state. And yet the state itself... it's kind of concentration in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a form of concentration.
Yes.
And it's not the goal of the practice, but it's a state that allows us to see something very profound.
It does. Yeah. So I have one quick question.
But it's free, time to stop.
Free will versus determinism. Can you comment on that?
Well, maybe next week. That's a whole question. Actually, next week I'm away. I'm going on a little vacation.
Just remember
that. Following week, free will and determinism. Okay, that's the topic. We'll try to talk about that the next time. Thank you.